I personally came in contact with Buddhism more than 50 years ago, and that was in London. London, England, perhaps I should say. At that time, there was only one Buddhist group in London, and very likely in the whole of Great Britain. And it had about a dozen active members. Just a dozen. I can remember us meeting during the war. We met in a little room in central London, not very far from the British Museum. And I can remember that on one occasion we were sitting there meditating. Well, at least we were just sitting there with our eyes closed and, you know, trying to experience some inner peace. We were sitting there meditating, and suddenly there was a terrific noise and the windows rattled. Of course, a bomb had fallen. Huh? It was wartime. But I'm very glad to say that nobody moved. Huh? Nobody moved. Now, whether this is Buddhist equanimity or British phlegm, I'm not so sure. But nobody moved. Perhaps we were all waiting for somebody else to move first. But we sat there and we finished our meditation. So that was Buddhism in Britain, 50 years ago. Well, now there's at least a couple of dozen flourishing Buddhist groups just in London, including four or five FWBO groups. And there are hundreds of Buddhist groups in Britain throughout the country. And of course, as you all know very well, it's the same here in America. Here, there are probably several thousand Buddhist groups, large and small, representing nearly all the Eastern Buddhist traditions. We have, as you know, Tibetan Buddhism. We've got the Nyingma Pas, we've got the Kagyu Pas, the Sakya Pas, and the Gelugpas, and all their various subdivisions. I think there are about 14 to 16 subdivisions of the Kagyu Pas alone. And then we've got the Theravada. We've got Sri Lankan Theravada, Burmese Theravada, Thai Theravada, Cambodian Theravada, and of course all the various forms of Vipassana, the very, very strict and the relatively liberal and so on and so forth. And we've got Chan or Zen in various forms, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese. We've got also Pure Land Buddhism. We've got Shingon. We've got Nichiren, all with many different subdivisions. And these have all come to the West, at least as addressed to Westerners, within the last 20 or 30 years. I'm not referring here, of course, to the so-called ethnic Buddhist communities. These have all come to the West within the last 20 or 30 years. And this is really a tremendous, a radical cultural development between them. All these different groups and Buddhist traditions represent a vast expansion of our spiritual horizons. Before, our knowledge of religion was limited to Christianity. Perhaps we'd just about heard of Islam, perhaps if we'd read about the Crusades. But now, what to speak just of Buddhism? We know, at least we've heard, of so many different religions of the world. And yes, within the field of Buddhism itself alone, there's been this vast expansion of our spiritual horizon. Again, reminiscing a bit, when I was a teenager in London, you never heard about yoga, you never heard about meditation. But nowadays in Britain, I think almost every person has heard about yoga, almost every person has heard about meditation. So that even if in a very ordinary family, your son and your daughter tells you, well, I'm going along to a Buddhist group and I'm meditating, no one is the least surprised. It's not unusual. Same with vegetarianism. There have been these great changes. So we're presented nowadays, spiritually speaking, with marvelous opportunities. opportunities for understanding and practicing so many different forms of Buddhism. But there's also a danger. And the danger is what we may be called spiritual consumerism. Or perhaps I should say pseudo-spiritual consumerism. Nowadays, we are consumers almost by definition. I consume, therefore I am. Or I shop, therefore I am. That just about sums up our philosophy. And of course, there's a danger that we bring this attitude with us, this consumerist attitude, when we approach Buddhism itself, especially when Buddhism is presented to us in so many tempting varieties, so wonderful, so mysterious, so exotic, so fascinating. Okay? We can't sort of wait to just get our little sticky paws on them. We can in fact speak almost of a sort of smorgasbord of spiritual goodies, just waiting there to be devoured. And so we sort of pick and choose as the fancy takes us. And we become not Buddhists, not people who go for refuge, we become just consumers of Buddhism. So, to be a Buddhist consumer, or rather a consumer of Buddhism, is the very antithesis of transformation, which is, of course, another of the great themes with which we're concerned in this conference. In consumerism, we assimilate Buddhism to ourselves. We assimilate it, at least in its externals, assimilate it to our own greed, our own hatred, our own delusion. But in transformation, we assimilate ourselves to Buddhism. One of the most prominent features of our consumer society is advertising. The more advertising, the more consumption. The more consumption, the more advertising, the more consumption, and the more consumption, the more advertising, because out of your profits you of course invest a certain amount in further advertising, and it becomes a vicious circle. And nowadays, of course, Buddhism itself comes to be advertised. Up to a point, this is not a bad thing. We can certainly advertise such things as meditation cushions and incense. We can even advertise courses and classes in Buddhism. But there are some things which simply cannot be advertised. We cannot advertise enlightenment, and we cannot advertise such things as tantric initiation. Yet this is what is happening. More than 30 years ago, I myself received a number of tantric initiations. I received them in Kalimpong and Darjeeling in the eastern Himalayas. I lived in Kalimpong, by the way, for some 14 years. For 14 years, that was my headquarters. And I was very fortunately situated. I arrived there in 1950 and I left in 1964. So I was there when refugee Tibetan lamas started pouring out of Tibet, especially after 1959, when His Holiness also left Tibet and took refuge in India. So So I was ideally situated, as it were, to intercept some of the greatest and most famous and eminent of these refugee Tibetan lamas, Nyingma Pa, Gelugpa, Shakyapa, and Kagyupa. And I was so fortunate as to be able to receive teachings and initiations from a number of them. They're nearly all dead now, I'm sorry to say. Only one of them, that is Chatul Sangi Dorji, is still alive. And I mention this because at that time, when I received those tantric initiations, I was told, tantric initiation is a very secret thing. Tantric initiation is a very sacred thing. It's not to be talked about. In fact, one of my Tibetan Lama teachers told me that I was permitted to speak about a particular initiation I had received only with one other person whom he named. That was how secret it was in those days. But nowadays, in the West, tantric initiation is actually being advertised. Even Anuttara Yoga Tantra, the highest yoga tantra, is being advertised. One enrolls for a weekend course. One pays one's fee, and one gets initiated, perhaps along with several hundred other people. And one doesn't have to prepare oneself. One doesn't even have to be a Buddhist. And this is certainly not in accordance with the Buddhist Vajrayana tradition. I remember one of my teachers telling me that if one wanted to practice Anuttara Yoga Tantra, one first of all had to practice the Hinayana. He used the term Hinayana. Nowadays we usually say Theravada. For 12 years. One then practiced the Mahayana for 6 years. Then one practiced the Outer Tantra for 6 years. And only then would one be considered ready to receive Anuttara Yoga Tantra initiation. But nowadays it seems one can do it all in the course of a weekend. Of course, some teachers will justify this. They will say that they are planting seeds which will mature in the future. But I must say that I personally reject this explanation as a shameful rationalization. If one really wants to plant seeds, one should teach Buddhist ethics. And that brings me back to the precepts, back to the four basic precepts about which I promised to say a few words. But first let me clear up a possible misunderstanding. I've said we should not become consumers of Buddhism, should not pick and choose from the spiritual smorgasbord. But of course, we may have to study several forms of Buddhism before we find one to which we can wholeheartedly commit ourselves. But we should study them seriously. And once we've committed ourselves to a certain form of Buddhism, a certain tradition, we should stick to it. At least, I would say, for 10 to 15 years. At the same time, we should maintain a friendly attitude towards other forms of Buddhism and the followers of other forms of Buddhism, and try to understand what it is that we have in common with them. Because after all, we are all Buddhists. We all go for refuge, regardless of the particular tradition within which we go for refuge, though it must be admitted that some traditions place more emphasis on the going for refuge and others less.